Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 187 of the True Crime All the Time Unsolved podcast. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my partner in true crime, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing okay.
You're doing okay?
Doing okay, man.
I mean, I always ask you how you are. I think now more than ever, people really want to know how you are, because obviously you've been sick. You're doing much better, but that pneumonia will not go away.
No, it's got a hold on me.
And so, you know, last week we took it pretty easy. We put out older Patreon episodes, but we did new intros.
Right.
This week we are doing a full-blown episode on both TCAT and TCAT Unsolved.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks to how much better you're doing, but you still got a ways to go.
Oh, man. Definitely got a ways to go.
And I think it speaks to what a trooper you are.
I am a trooper.
You're a trooper. You're a battler. And I told people that all along. Gibby's a fighter. He will kick this thing in the rear end. So I mention true crime all the time. Right now, we have an episode out on Yaz Issa. This is an interesting case. A lot of people may be familiar with it. They may not be. But, you know, Yaz was a pretty prominent doctor.
Yeah.
And really just a guy, Gibbs, that wanted out of his marriage. He wanted to be free to live kind of a playboy lifestyle, but he didn't want to give up his money.
It's always the problem.
And so he murdered his wife.
Sex, greed, and
rock and roll.
Something like that.
I don't know if rock and roll was involved, but all those other things definitely were.
Sex, greed, and lies.
And we have a good episode on tap for everyone on Unsolved. But before we jump into that, let's give our Patreon shout outs. We had Natasha.
Hey, Natasha.
Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Julie Johnson.
Hey, thanks, Julie.
CJ Tackett.
What's going on, CJ?
Jan Hughes.
Hey, Jan.
Olympia Victoria Havney.
Look at that name. Hey, Olympia.
Yeah. That's a very commanding name.
It is.
Like, you feel like you're in someone's presence, like that of authority.
They probably feel like they have to achieve something.
Like, respect my authority.
Yeah.
Andrea Drummer.
Hey, Andrea.
Anne Marie Hoff.
Thank you, Anne.
Jessica Shives Conrad.
What's up, Jessica Shives Conrad?
We had Nancy Rodriguez.
What's happening, Rodriguez?
Robert Waters.
Hey, Robert.
Karen.
What's going on, good old Karen?
Gina Q.
Hey, Gina.
Krista Ayers.
Hey, Krista.
Chloe Eggleston.
What's happening, Eggleston?
Catherine Shirley.
Hey, Catherine.
Lori Williams.
Appreciate it, Lori.
Tracy Ann Campbell.
Hey, Tracy Ann.
John Ivy.
What's going on, Ivy League?
Laurel Fay.
Hey, Fay.
Lindsay Lute.
What's up, LL?
Jamie Lynn Bratt Bushnell.
Oh, look at that name, Bratt Bushnell.
It's a mouthful.
It's like that really good binoculars, right, Bushnell?
It is.
Yeah.
And last but not least, Hannah Lillian.
Hey, appreciate it, Hannah.
And then if we go back into the vault, Gibbs, this week we selected Robert Baker.
Well, thank you, Robert.
So we appreciate Robert. We appreciate the new support, the continued Patreon support. All of that has helped us, especially this year, keep the show going. We had some great PayPal donations as well. Carolyn Burkhart.
Hey, thanks, Carolyn.
Suzanne Gorham.
Hey, Suzanne.
Linda McLean.
McLean.
And Gina Farr.
Well, I like that. Hey, Gina.
All right, buddy. Are you ready to get into this episode of True Crime All the Time Unsolved?
I am.
We're talking about the unsolved murder of Rebecca Dawson McClung, and we're going back quite a ways. Rebecca's murder occurred in 1901. So this is definitely one of the oldest episodes we've done.
Yeah, it really is.
Not the oldest. I think we've been into the 1800s, back. But yeah. It's definitely an old case. It also happens to have occurred fairly close to where you and I are.
Yeah.
Probably about, less than 30 miles from the studio.
Yeah, I would say so.
In Mason, Ohio. Rebecca was born in 1840, the daughter of Ezra Dawson. She had three brothers, Servetus, Nicholas, and Nimrod.
I always thought Nimrod was a made-up name. See, now I'm learning stuff as I researched.
Well, I have heard the name before, but it is definitely something that over the years has been used in a derogatory fashion.
For sure.
Right? Yeah. I mean, when you were younger, don't you remember people calling other people Nimrods?
Oh, yeah. You Nimrod, you.
Yeah. I don't know where that came from, but obviously there must have been a person named Nimrod.
I always thought there was a famous captain of a boat or something named Nimrod, but maybe I'm getting that mixed up with whoever was the captain of the submarine of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. I don't remember what his name was, but I think it might have been something similar to that.
Captain Nemo?
Yeah, Nemo.
Now, I don't know how similar Nemo and Nimrod is, but I got you.
Right there.
the N part. Yeah. Very similar.
Very similar.
But, I'm thinking there must have been a famous person named Nimrod in history, and they did something that maybe was viewed as dumb or something like that. And that's where the term Nimrod came from. Yeah. I don't know.
Somebody will let us know. Someone will actually Google it.
I'm sure they will. Yeah. And we could take the time to do that before the show.
We could, but we...
But we don't, because we want to give the people... we want it to be interactive.
Yes. So go check it out.
In 1871, Rebecca married John McClung, a retired farmer. He was known as the county's wealthiest man. He was also known as a miser or curmudgeon, but an honest man.
Well...
And maybe that's how he became the county's wealthiest man.
Could have been.
Much like yourself, by being a miser and a curmudgeon. Yeah. What is a curmudgeon? Just not happy with
grumpy.
Anything? Okay, that's not you. No. You definitely are what I would call a miser. There's more up-to-date terms for it.
Sure.
Penny pincher.
Tightwad.
Tightwad.
Tight ass. Yeah, whatever. Yeah.
But, you're definitely falling into that category. You're not the county's wealthiest man, though.
No.
That's for sure.
I'd have to, seek out, like, a really, really tiny county.
And you still wouldn't be.
And it'd be rough. It'd still be rough. Yeah.
There'd be some farmer who's got more money than you would ever possibly imagine.
I just moved here and didn't research that good, did I?
So, the two of them resided in John's home at 101 East Main Street. This was known as a mansion to the locals back then in the village of Mason. Their home was a 10-room, 2-story brick home. Very impressive then, and it pretty much is today.
Yeah, it really is.
The house also had a barn, and it sat on 950 acres of land.
That's a big farm.
It's a big farm, and I'm telling you right now, Gibbs, if you had 950 acres of land in Mason, Ohio,
oh my God,
you would be the richest man in the county
and
maybe the state.
Maybe the state, that's a high-end area right there.
Yeah, it wasn't, but it has grown up over time to be kind of an enclave of wealthy high-end.
I think to buy a house there, you gotta start out like in the close to the $800,000 range and up. Now it's pretty expensive.
Yeah, for our neck of the woods, right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you were saying that in California, people would be like, "Huh?
Well, that's entry level.
That's every street."
Yeah.
But in our neck of the woods, $800,000 is a pretty high end home.
It really is.
Now, I think what was interesting about Rebecca and John is that they led an extremely unconventional life. There wasn't a person back during that time who claimed to have ever seen the mansion doors or window coverings open.
Yeah.
Sounds like they were a little reclusive. Yeah. And I think the other bizarre part of their lives was less than a handful of people had ever seen Rebecca since she moved into the home, because I don't think she ever or very rarely left it.
Yeah, it's bizarre in that type of a small village,
Yeah, many of the locals claimed that Rebecca would simply peep from, out behind the window blinds and shutters during the day. She apparently liked to keep track of what was going on outside of the home, but she wouldn't actually open them.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you right now, my grandfather was the same way. He was so nosy, and I'll use that word, about what was going on outside of his house.
Yeah.
he would stand at the window and just kind of, you know how you prop open the blind with one finger?
Just sit there and stare.
Huh? And he would just stare. And he'd be like, oh, so-and-so's got somebody over. I mean, they're like, hey, why don't you come back and we're watching a football game or something.
But he didn't want anybody else to see what's going on in his house, right?
No. Yeah. No, but he was so interested in what was going on around him. It was said that Rebecca's family was estranged because John had sued her brothers for $350 and won, and they didn't want to pay.
Sure.
$350 in the late 1800s, early 1900s, it's a boatload of money.
It's a lot of cashola.
You want to convert that to today's dollars?
Oh, my gosh.
Beep, boop, boop.
$80,000.
Well, you pulled that out of somewhere. I won't say where.
My arse.
Of your arse. But, you know, if you think about it, a ton of money. I don't know what the lawsuit was over, but essentially they were avoiding John.
Sure.
And therefore avoiding Rebecca because they don't want to pay that money back. I don't even know if they had the money to pay it back.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I couldn't find really anything to definitively say why, but John had essentially kind of, I don't know if you want to say disowned, kind of frozen his own family out of the couple's life. So again, a very reclusive couple. Now there were rumblings, people that felt that Rebecca was kind of forced into this lifestyle and it was John who was telling her not to leave the house, not to open any of the doors or blinds.
Well, he is the wealthiest man in the county. So, and he's a miser. So maybe he's like, hey.
And a curmudgeon.
And a curmudgeon on top of that. So he's a little grumpy.
Did you say curmudgeon?
I probably did. Hey, curmudgeon, whatever. It's the same thing.
Well, I got the feeling, Gibbs, and right or wrong, that John was this way all along. I don't know if Rebecca was, but it was almost like she became this way as well after they married and moved into the home.
Yeah.
Right or wrong, I don't know. But that's the way it kind of seems to me.
Sure.
In late March of 1901, John and Rebecca sold the mansion for $5,000 to Albert Dill and Sally Bayshore. Again, big money in 1901.
Yeah, that'd be like, now, if you're talking just the cash equivalent, it's probably like $150,000, maybe $175,000. But if you're talking real estate, it's a whole nother ballpark. You got to be like...
Wait a minute there, Mr. Wizard.
Yeah.
How do we get from... You said $350 was $80,000.
Yeah.
Now you're saying $5,000 is $150,000,
$175,000. Yeah, I overshot the $350,000.
That does not compute.
Yeah, the $350,000 I went too high.
Okay.
Yeah. But the $5,000, I think that's probably going to be like around $150,000.
I think it's going to be more.
But if you're talking real estate... Then it's definitely going to be more because we know how Mason is.
I think it's going to be a lot more.
That would be closer to 800 to $1 million today, real estate wise.
I'm shooting higher.
All right.
We'll see.
Did you go get your Mensa certificate or something?
But the thing is, they wanted to build a new home.
Right.
I mean, that was the reason for the sale.
Sure.
Part of the agreement was that the McClungs could rent back half of the house from the buyers until their new home was built. So the new buyers occupied half of the home while John and Rebecca were in the other half. On April 12th, 1901, 61-year-old Rebecca McClung was found dead in her home on the second floor in her bedroom shortly after 5 a.m. She had been hit in the head with a blunt object. Her husband, 75-year-old John, claims that he left their mansion and went out to the barn to work and milk the cows for about an hour and a half, and then returned home to wake up Rebecca only to find her dead. Now, remember, they got this other couple living in the other half of the house. So he called out to Sally Bayshore for help. He also asked the family doctor to come to the home as soon as possible. Sally contacted the authorities who arrived at the house that morning. When the authorities got to the home, They found John at the bedside of Rebecca. Rebecca's head had essentially been crushed, and she was lying in a pool of blood. John told the authorities that he and his wife had always been on good terms, and they had just gone under contract for a new house. He said he agreed to buy the new house to please her, as he knew it was important to her. So I think Gibbs, what he's saying is they were happy.
Yeah, they were in a good spot together.
Yeah. Why would we be buying this new house and making these plans if we weren't happy to be, you know, moving soon into this new house?
Yeah.
But the investigators asked him if he thought he could have killed her while he was temporarily insane. I think a question that probably a lot of detectives don't ask today.
No.
Seems somewhat strange.
Right.
He told them, if I did it, I didn't know it. Okay. We got to break this down.
Sure.
Again, I think the question is strange in today's world.
Right.
Maybe that was pretty common in the early 1900s. I don't know.
Seems strange to me.
But then when you look at his answer, if I did it, I didn't know it. I don't think that's how most people would answer that question. They would say, no, man, I didn't have anything to do with this.
Why are you asking me that?
It seems like a very odd thing to say versus just saying, no, I did not kill my wife. So again, I think it's strange, and I think it's something that, you know, could definitely lead down a very certain path for John McClung. The next day, April 13th, 1901, the police had a couple of theories about what they thought might have happened. One of those theories was that John McClung had concerns that if he died before Rebecca, his estate, which at the time was worth over $100,000, a lot of money.
Sure.
And this brand new house that he had just contracted to have built would eventually go to Rebecca's brothers, Servetus, Nicholas, and Nimrod. I still have a hard time saying that word.
Nimrod.
Or that name.
You Nimrod. You.
Without it chuckling, at least. There's going to be a Nimrod out there who's saying, hey, why are you laughing at my name, man?
Yeah, we'd be like, we have a new Patreon member.
Nimrod. I'm telling you right now, in 2020 or 21, if you have a baby and you name that baby Nimrod, that's just mean. I'm just flat going to come out and say it. I got to be honest about that.
Well, now we just lost our Nimrod audience.
We lost the whole Nimrod audience.
Yeah.
So they theorized that this was a fear of John's because he was not on good terms, as we mentioned, with her brothers, and he didn't want a single penny of his money, his estate, to go to them at any point in time.
Exactly.
Right. So if he died and then let's say a few years later, Rebecca died, her family would most likely get all the money. He'd already locked his family out of his life.
Yeah.
He probably didn't have anything going to them. And she wasn't going to be in a position to probably give them a bunch of money either. She would have given it to her family.
I'm guessing he'd rather have his family get the money than her family. Who knows?
Well, anybody but her family.
Right.
From the way that I took it. The other theory was that once they signed the contract to build this new home, and we mentioned it, they had already sold their mansion to Albert and Sally for $5,000. They started to disagree on exactly what this new house should be, because it was said that in the days leading up to the murder, John and Rebecca argued over the new home size. She wanted a really large home, and he didn't. He wanted a little bit smaller home. But at some point, John had agreed to Rebecca's wishes because the house design was to be a fairly large house. It was just the night before the murder that John signed the contract for the new home with a contractor named George Tetrick to have the 14-room house built. Once it was completed, Gibbs. It would have been the largest home in Mason at that time.
Yeah. Expensive.
But according to this theory that the police came up with, at some point, John realized what he had done was a mistake. And he allowed it to get into his mind that, you know what, he gave in to Rebecca. He wished he hadn't done that. It caused him to go mad, and he killed her in an act of rage. Now, they thought, again, back to this, it was temporary.
Yeah.
Temporary insanity, temporary derangement. There were a lot of terms thrown around, but it was all centered around the fact that it was a temporary moment of
very brief
of whatever that caused him to commit this murder. And again, we're speaking about, these are all just theories floated out around by the police. Other people theorized that Rebecca was killed during a break-in because it was rumored that the couple kept large sums of cash inside the mansion. And it was said that there were several crews of men working just down the street from the home. So I think this theory, Gibbs, centers around these men somehow getting wind that the couple kept a large amount of cash.
Right.
And they went to get it. Somehow they ended up killing Rebecca. I think the problem with this theory is that police didn't find any signs of a break-in. There wasn't anything missing from the home. It wasn't a burglary type scenario.
No.
And it didn't seem to be a break-in, violent home invasion type scenario either. The authorities found two smaller ash logs with blood and tissue on them near the fireplace. And the fireplace was next to the bed where Rebecca was found. They also found bark from the logs lying on the floor. They found blood and tissue on this bark. So I think from that, police pretty quickly theorized that this was most likely the murder weapon, a log, some type, one of these ash logs. Authorities talked to Sally Bayshore, who told them that she heard Rebecca scream for help four times. Then she heard someone go down the steps at 4:30 a.m. She said around 5 a.m., she saw John out at the barn looking at his coat and pants. And as she put it, it was as though he had something on them. She said she then saw him walk towards the home. This was when she heard him call out for help. So based on all of this, authorities placed John McClung under house arrest until they could get a preliminary hearing to determine if he would be charged with anything related to Rebecca's murder. So what they did was they put officers at both doors to make sure that he didn't leave the house.
Seems a little strange to leave the potential suspect at the murder scene.
In the house where other people live.
Yeah.
Yeah. It does seem a little strange, yeah. But, you know, it's 1901. Did they not have like a jail cell that they could have put him in? Yeah. Or
was it because he was the richest man in the county? They didn't want to mess with him.
Maybe.
It's just a little strange.
But it does seem strange. You're right. To allow a suspected murderer to remain living at the murder scene.
Yeah.
Now, you could make the argument that that kind of happens today if somebody gets out on bond, but this is kind of happening very quickly.
Right.
But I want to go back and take a step back to Sally Bayshore. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about this, but my assumption, Gibbs, is that once they talked to Sally, this kind of timeline that she laid out for them, for the police, essentially punched a hole in the statement that John McClung gave, as far as the timeline went.
Yeah, I mean, I think it didn't help his case.
Yeah, didn't help because, you know, John saying he was out, he did say he was out there, mm-hmm. right, milking the cows.
Yeah.
She's putting him out there earlier than I think he put himself out there. She's also saying, okay, he's inspecting his clothes as though something might have been on them. And, you know, that coupled with hearing Rebecca scream and all of this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like saying, I heard her scream at 4:30, heard someone go down the steps. Next thing I see him out the you know, 5 o'clock out at the barn looking at his clothes, and then he's coming into the house. So if it looked to her as if maybe he had blood on him, at that point, you know that he had to been in the house to get that blood. He didn't get it when he came back in the second time to be by her bedside.
Yeah, and maybe I should have said it's really more of the 430 screens.
Yes.
That probably put police onto John.
Exactly, yeah.
Because I think he was making the case that how could I have done it? I was outside at 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
But now, you know, Sally's kind of putting the murder more around the 4:30 time frame. The coroner who, it seems to me, Gibbs, back in those days, had a much larger role in the actual investigation of the murder, maybe, than they do today.
I think it stepped outside of just medical a little bit more.
Yeah, because the coroner came out and actually talked to the press and said that his belief was that John McClung had hit Rebecca in the head, killing her, while laboring under mental aberration. Again, everybody's just quick to say, like, this is a switch was flipped.
Yeah.
And I think maybe much more so than today, I think that's what a lot of people believed back then. People just didn't go around killing people. Yeah. Something really wrong had to have happened, but it could happen temporarily. And then all of a sudden they were fine.
Right.
I think that was the belief that was held by a lot of people. It definitely seems to be that way in this case.
Evil creeped in and got a hold of you. Yeah.
The coroner indicated that Rebecca had an extensive depressed fracture to her skull over her left eye. The fracture also involved the entire base of her skull on the interior portion. He further stated that all the bones in her face were fractured except for her lower jaw. So, I mean, I think when you take those statements in their entirety, it really paints a picture that this was an extremely brutal beating.
Rage
that caused her to die.
Yeah. This is not one hit.
Yes. And I think you're on to something, right? Rage because of the number, the viciousness, the extent of her injuries. The funeral for Rebecca McClung occurred on April 14th. And there was quite a few people, a few thousand people attended her service.
That's a big number.
Yeah. Because my assumption is, Mason was not a highly populated place in 1901.
No.
So when you're talking about thousands of people attending a funeral, that's a big deal.
I think some of them just wanted to, you probably heard about it and wanted to see what this was all about. You know, when they got there, it was a closed casket, obviously.
Obviously.
But maybe they thought it wouldn't be. Maybe they just wanted to see what the whole, you know, thing was about. In fact, I mean, you didn't have TV, right? 1901?
No.
TV? So what was your entertainment anyway?
There was no TV in 1901. Yeah. But I do think you're onto something. And there's a morbid curiosity that a lot of people have. And back then, not only did you not have TV, no internet. I mean, We're so desensitized today. In 1901, this would have been a very huge deal.
And in researching, as I know you're aware, when you read the newspapers back in 1901, they read like a novel, like entertainment, like, you know what I mean? Not like they are today. I mean, back then they really wrote.
Yeah, because where else were people getting their information?
Yeah.
There was no Twitter.
No.
There was no TikTok, whatever the hell that is. TikTok. My kids are into that TikTok. I still don't even know what it is. The sad thing is they're getting their news from all these places.
We're going to have a TCAT TikTok.
TikTok.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's where people got their information from. So you couldn't hit a button on your phone and get up-to-date stuff. So I think there's something to that, what you're saying.
Right.
The writing was much more flowy and extensive. Now, was it always right? I don't know.
Yeah.
Is it always right today?
No.
I don't know. I would say no. John McClung was allowed to attend the funeral and was accompanied by his sister. He told the press that he did not want the service at the mansion because he didn't want everyone kind of nosing through his home, I think were his words.
Yeah. Not surprised.
Not surprised from a very extremely private man.
And I did read in another article that his sister and his brother came to his defense because even though he shut him out, they still cared about him. Maybe because of the money.
I was going to say, he did have quite a bit of money. Yeah. Maybe we should come to John's defense because the old boy's got quite a bit of cash.
Yeah. So they were quick to forgive him for cutting them out of his life for all that time.
Sure.
So
John's attorney told the press at the service that his client did not commit this murder. He was innocent and would be cleared of this charge in due time. I think the one thing that this case does show is how quickly things kind of moved back in that time period. Yeah. Because the day after the funeral, and again, this is like 3 days after the murder, April 15th, the preliminary trial of John McClung began. It started at 10:30 a.m. And according to the local papers, the mayor's courtroom was so packed by the public that they had to move it to the Village Opera House, which was twice as big as the courtroom. And even still, it wasn't big enough because the public was spilling outside of that venue. And I think it goes back to what you said about the funeral. It wasn't just people from Mason. There was people from all over.
Just coming in.
Coming in, people wanting to see what was going on. They were curious about, maybe they had read it in the paper.
Free entertainment.
Yeah.
If you weren't working, why wouldn't you want to just go up there and hang out and hear what's going on?
Well, you couldn't watch Schitt's Creek on Netflix, so
no,
you had to find something to do.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't have been as big as a hit back then as it is today.
No, probably not. John McClung was represented by a top defense attorney named Runyon. He was actually a judge in the neighboring city of Lebanon. Now, a lot of people thought this was a conflict of interest.
Yeah, because you know all the judges in the county know each other. So how does one judge represent a client to his buddy that is sitting, you know, in the other city over this murder case?
Yeah, it is very strange. Obviously, you would never see that happen today. Now, the state of Ohio sent in a prosecuting attorney who had a really good record for cases in the area. The prosecution called Sally Bayshore, who was staying on her side of the mansion at the time of the murder. Mrs. Bayshore told the court again that she heard four screams of help coming from the McClung side of the mansion around 4:30 a.m. She also said that Mr. McClung called out to her after he was inside the home after being out in the barn. The next witness was Albert Dill, Mrs. Bayshore's partner in the purchase of the mansion. Dill said he saw Mr. McClung coming from the barn around 5:10 to the house. Albert said he went to the barn shortly after seeing Mr. McClung walking back to the mansion. When he got out to the barn, he noticed that John had been working out there doing his usual routine like he did every morning. And I think this was good for the defense, right? Because it made it sound like this is what John McClung did every day. He had been outside doing his morning chores, which meant, okay, someone else had to have gone into the home and killed Rebecca.
Well, sure, because after all, John was out in the barn.
Now, the prosecution told the court that it was just an assumption that McClung had worked out there in the morning. No one saw him out there prior to him walking back to the house. And I think that's where you and I kind of talked about this very important timeline.
Right.
Right. The screams at 4:30. Sally Bayshore says she heard someone come down the stairs, leave the house, but right, she doesn't see that person.
No.
She only sees John McClung later on outside.
Looking at his coat, pants, like there's something on it.
And Albert Dill sees him outside later after the 4:30 time frame. The third witness was a guy named Mr. Gramage. He was the first person to go inside the mansion after the murder. He told the court how Rebecca McClung was found lying in her bed, the position of her body, and what her body looked like. The fourth witness was Dr. Hall, who had Rebecca's brain on display to show the courtroom the damage that occurred and how it most likely happened in his medical opinion.
That'd be kind of freaky.
Yeah, I don't think in a lot of trials today you'd have the victim's actual brain
right
in the courtroom, floating in, I don't know, some kind of liquid.
Right, pass the jar around, everybody.
Now, you might have a plastic model that has been built to look like, you know, what the brain looked like. I don't know. Obviously, they didn't have that technology in 1901, so they just brought the brain right in.
Let's just bring the real one in now.
But I'll go back to my talk about how we are kind of desensitized today. Go back to 1901. Imagine jurors sitting in a courtroom looking at Rebecca's brain. I mean, you talk about a shocker.
Well, if it was around lunchtime, I'm sure everybody skipped lunch.
Yeah, it's just not something that, you know, I believe people were accustomed to, seeing that kind of shocking visual. We see all kinds of them today.
Oh, yeah.
Day in and day out. But back then, they didn't.
Remember that series?
Faces of Death?
Is that the one where they did the monkey brains?
Yes.
Yeah, remember that?
Oh, yeah.
You knew what I was going to say.
You just asked me if I remembered it. I guessed what it was before you even got any of it out.
That's really good.
That's the one that we as kids used to go down to the local video store when they had the VHS rentals.
Yeah.
And you're supposed to be 18, but they'd always let us rent it.
Right.
And then we go home and watch it, you know, try to sneak it past our parents. And I mean, that was pretty gruesome back then.
It really was.
I mean, you can go on YouTube and see stuff way worse than that now.
But back then, I just remember seeing that and I didn't want to watch it.
No.
Like, oh, I don't want to. Monkey brains, what? Eating chilled? No.
And that was, you know, what, maybe 30 plus years ago.
Yeah.
Backtrack all the way to 1901, and I think it really kind of illustrates the difference.
I didn't even like it in the Indiana Jones one when they were...
And you knew that one was fake.
Fake, yeah. Poor monkeys.
Those poor monkeys. The fifth witness was the coroner, Dr. Carsey, and he presented John McClung's bloody coat to the court. He also presented some pieces of bark that came off the two ash logs that were believed to be the murder weapons. And Gibbs, in all the research that we did, you know, one thing I found very interesting was that the papers and even in the courts, they frequently referred to John McClung as Old Man McClung.
Yeah, that was bizarre.
It seems strange.
Like you call me Old Gibby.
Yeah,
old
I don't,
Gibby.
But
yeah.
I mean, granted, the guy was like 75 years old, but, you know, to have the paper say Old Man Ferguson, I'm not going to be real happy about that.
No. Miser.
At the preliminary hearing, they moved forward with charging McClung with the murder of his wife. It was sent to the grand jury, who charged him with second-degree murder, which was manslaughter. A bond of $5,000 was set, and he was released to his brother, Frank McClung, on this $5,000 bond. But they also sent a couple of marshals along to keep an eye on him.
Make sure this 75-year-old guy doesn't escape.
Well, this is a 75-year-old man with a boatload of money.
True.
So $5,000 is a ton of money.
Yeah.
But not when you're worth over $100,000 and your life is, your freedom's on the line.
Yeah. You definitely can buy a way out of town.
Because you're already 75 years old.
Yeah.
I don't think most people lived to be 75 in 1901.
No.
So you're already on borrowed time.
Exactly.
if you're spending any time in prison, you're most likely dying in prison.
Right.
And I don't think he wanted that money to go to anybody anyway.
No.
So
I think he wanted to make sure he used every penny of it.
The chances of him, you know, going on the run, he was a pretty big flight risk.
Yeah.
The murder trial began in June of 1901. And again, I think it kind of illustrates, right, how much quicker things progressed in the court systems back then versus today.
Yeah, moving along fairly
very quickly. During the trial, at one point, it had to be stopped because Mrs. Bayshore, who was really the main witness for the prosecution, couldn't bear to give her testimony, and she actually fainted. So they had to adjourn for the day to attend to her. But the next day, when placed on the stand to tell her story about what she heard, she fainted again and had to be removed from the courtroom.
Obviously, it was very rough for her to relive that nightmare.
And again, I do think, not to belabor this point, but I think it speaks to what people were used to seeing and hearing about back during that time period. Yeah. You know, that was so traumatic for her that she could not even talk about it without fainting.
Well, so if you were in the bedroom next door and you heard somebody scream four times, help, 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 and found out that someone beat her in the face, I think, I don't know if you could, I mean, you stomach that. It'd be difficult, especially if you didn't, because you didn't do anything.
Are you saying, like, if it happened to me?
Yeah.
I think I could get on the stand and talk about what I heard.
Yeah.
But again, I think it's because we're used to.
Well, that's true.
Hearing about and even seeing images that are pretty gruesome, pretty violent. Yeah. Much more so than they were
back then.
Back then. The prosecution called witness Dr. Van Wyk, who was called to the bedside that morning of the murder by John McClung. He told the court that once he was at Rebecca's bedside, as ordered by John, he saw Rebecca's face mashed into a jelly. This is what he said.
Yeah.
I mean, I think going back to how brutally a murder scene this really was, we mentioned it before. Every bone in her face was crushed besides her lower jaw, and she was lying in a large pool of blood. Officer Reed, who was on site the day of the murder, testified that John had blood stains on his pants, coat, and vest. Now, John claimed that the stains got on there 2 days prior to the murder after he cut his hand. So that's how he was trying to explain the blood stains.
Sure.
On July 11th, 1901, John McClung was acquitted by a jury after they deliberated for about 6 hours. The final arguments wrapped up at 10 a.m. and the verdict came down at 4 p.m. I think, Gibbs, most people agreed with the acquittal back then because they felt as though the prosecution just didn't have enough evidence to convict John. But on the flip side, I think law enforcement was very adamant that they had the man who killed Rebecca. And they thought that it was the fact that he was extremely wealthy and he had the resources that got him out from under these murder charges.
A lot of people would believe that still today in that town.
Well, and not just about John back in 1901, right? I think there are a lot of people that believe if you have enough money, that you can get away with murder. And I think we've seen some examples of that.
Yeah, we have.
to kind of back that up, unfortunately. So another interesting aspect of this case is that, you know, the county, up to the point where Rebecca was murdered, they had already seen a pretty long list of unsolved murders. This just added to it.
Yeah. It didn't make the community feel all safe and warm inside either because of it.
Including Rebecca's, they had 17 unsolved murders that were all pretty violent. And they had suspects. In many of these murders, the problem was that these people had been able to elude or evade trial, or when they were actually taken to trial, they were acquitted.
Maybe they had better attorneys, whatever, but they were able to get off.
After John's acquittal, he was hospitalized. We mentioned it. The guy was 75 years old.
It had to take a toll on him.
It did. It did. He died 3 years after that and was buried next to his wife. The famous mansion where Rebecca was murdered was eventually turned into a duplex, then a motel called the Modern Motel, then an interior design firm. Today, it's a restaurant called the Banana Leaf Modern Thai. And Gibbs, it's a pretty well-known restaurant. It's extremely popular.
Yeah. It's
I've never been there, but I hear it's actually really good.
Yeah, I know when you and I both actually worked down near this area.
Yeah.
And a few of the folks from the office would go there weekly. It was that good.
And Gibbs, we mentioned it right up front. Mason is one of the wealthier cities in the greater Cincinnati area, and probably one of the more affluent cities in the state of Ohio. Now, there's one more part to this story, and it involves the old mansion having some ghostly folklore behind it. Many locals over the years claim Rebecca never left the house on Main Street. There are a number of accounts of it being haunted. A previous owner of the home claimed to see Rebecca standing at the top of the home steps, dressed in black and wearing a long skirt. All right, I'm out at that point. I'm out.
You're like, that's all right. I don't care how good the Thai is here. I'm gone.
This was before it was a restaurant, right?
Well, I know.
I'm telling you, if I owned a home and saw a ghostly apparition,
yeah,
I'm calling an agent the next day, or if I can find one that night.
How about Ghostbusters?
I might call Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
But that house is going on the market, and I'm moving into a weekly motel, a B&B somewhere.
You're like, I'm out of here before Poltergeist hits. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't deal with that stuff. Another eyewitness said that he was in the home working when he heard someone come in. When he turned around, he saw a woman dressed in old-fashioned clothing who asked where Rebecca McClung had been buried. When he turned around again, the woman disappeared. Okay, the problem I have with that story is if you turn around and there's somebody there that looks very out of place,
right,
from another time,
yeah,
are you then going to turn back around and start working again on what you're doing?
Not me.
Not me. Again, I'm gone.
My eyes are focused.
You can get another contractor to finish up this business, homeowner, because I'm out. Another of the home's previous owners recalled an instance where she had opened some of the windows in the basement to air it out, and then she closed them at the end of the day. When she got home later, two of the windows were once again opened without, you know, any explanation. That one, yeah, I don't know. I'm not selling the house based on that one, probably.
Maybe if it happened a few more times.
Yeah, could have been a faulty latch. Who knows? Yeah,
maybe the kids opened it, didn't tell you.
But there have been reports of toppling chairs, slamming doors. There's too many reports for me. You know, one report's too many. I'm out.
Yeah.
You can have this mansion.
Good luck.
Good luck.
Yeah.
I'm moving out. But I think it adds an element to the case, to any case, right? Anytime you have kind of this ghostly aspect.
Right.
After the fact. Now, is it real? Who knows? I don't know. Do people find out that, you know, a woman was murdered in the house back in 1901? And then you start to, your mind starts to play some games with you a little bit.
Sure. Can you make it that you see something? Yeah. I remember when I went to the Stanley Hotel up in Colorado, what's, you know, supposed to be haunted. Stephen King wrote his novel there, all that stuff, right?
Red Rum. Yeah.
But, you know, they take you on this tour and they take you over to the old schoolhouse and they give you this candle to hold in your hand, right? And if it flickers, or right, they got these ways to make it seem like maybe somebody's in the room with you, because if the candle does this, there's somebody next to you. And then they take you down to the cellar of the hotel, right? The old hotel.
Yeah.
And again, they're also like, they're trying to show like the shooting lights going around you.
And yeah. Stuff, and I'm sure there's no air being pumped in or, you
yeah,
know,
you know, so like it's interesting, you know, so you can probably believe what you want to believe.
Oh, and I think a lot of people do. Right. I think you can also kind of, I don't want to use the word manufacture, but you can whip yourself into thinking things are there. I mean, that happens to me sometimes at night when I'm laying in bed, I hear something and I think, did I really hear it? Did I not hear it? I get up, there's nothing there. So,
but sometimes there is something there. So, you know,
well, yeah,
never know.
That's why you got to get in and check it out.
That's exactly right.
But I think it's a very interesting case. Happened fairly close to us. And, you know, even today, Gibbs, this case is still talked about in the city of Mason.
Yeah.
It's not a super well-known case, probably, you know, around the country. But around here, it's a case that people are still very intrigued with.
Yeah.
But that's it for the case of the murder of Rebecca McClung. We got some voicemails, Gibbs. You want to check those out?
Let's hear them.
Good day, mate. My name is Katie. I'm calling from Australia, but I'm originally from Ohio, so I feel quite connected to you guys when you talk about Ohio. But I just want to thank you for your podcast. I'm a nurse down here. You've gotten me through some just a bit of escapism during COVID, but we're very lucky here with our numbers and how we've handled it. So I really feel for America and all my friends and family back there. So I just want to say thank you. Love the podcast. Keep it going. And stay safe and keep your own time ticking. Ciao.
Well, good day. And it's funny, you know, you have a good Australian little bit of accent for Ohio girl.
Much better than you.
What are you trying to say?
That your accents are not good.
Razor blades? Or what was it? Razor blades. So, razor blades.
That's interesting, though. You know, an Ohio native makes their way to Australia. And she's a nurse. So, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for nurses. And you probably do really.
Oh, man.
Now.
Yeah.
Because they took good care of you.
They did.
Hey, Mike and Gibby. I have never left a voicemail for a podcast before. So this is a first for me. But I'm Lacey. I'm from Georgia. And I was just calling to let you guys know that you're killing me. I've just binged all of the Unsolved episodes, and then now I'm binging all of the regular true crime episodes, and I just finished the episode of Marvelous Keen, and when you said that he pulled a pea shooter out of his pants, I died. I absolutely died, and I'm pretty sure everyone at the gas station that I was pulling up at thinks I'm insane, because they all just saw me laughing so hard in my car that I was crying. So thank you for making my life fun after working a 12-hour shift. I absolutely love you guys, and keep your own time ticking.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's kind of funny. I got an email from someone the other day who was saying, like, they don't feel like we're trying to be funny. And most of the time, you and I are not. I mean, every now and then, something will pop into our head. But it's amazing how many people find certain things funny that you and I kind of said not meaning for them to be funny. And I've gotten people that have emailed saying that's kind of what they like. You know, it's not like we're trying to go over the top and be comedians, because we're not comedians at all. But again, I always go back to the point of, if it makes a person laugh, it makes their day brighter. If
it's awesome.
Does anything, if it helps them through a hard time, a loss, whatever it is that the podcast does for you, if it's positive, then that makes us feel good.
Absolutely.
And I think that's all we can ask for.
I'm 212. I got a major problem up here. I've got twin swimming pools in the kitchen and the living room. Thank you.
All right, Gib. So I think that this person called the wrong number.
You think?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I really kind of feel bad.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, they said I have twin swimming pools in my kitchen and my living room.
Yeah.
I didn't understand that at all.
It's an interesting home.
But what I think he was calling someone for help.
Yeah.
And now I really feel bad because he mistakenly dialed our podcast voicemail line, and he's probably waiting for a call back from whoever it was that he's trying to get.
I got to get this water out of here, man. Help me.
Well, don't have swimming pools in your kitchen and your living room.
Yeah.
But no, and seriously, I feel bad because hopefully after a day or two, he realized that,
hey. Doesn't it say when you called that you've reached the.
I don't remember what it says. Dude, I set that up like 4 years ago.
I'm sure it says something like, hey, thanks for calling. It may not
say anything.
Maybe you need to call it every now and then.
Knowing me, I didn't set anything up.
Probably didn't. Just goes beep.
Yeah, it probably does. You know, 4 years is a long time.
It is a long time. Maybe it's time to redo the message.
Maybe.
You won't even know how to redo the message. That's the problem.
I don't even, you know, yeah. It's worked so far.
Well, that's good.
Except for this guy.
Yeah.
Hey, Mike and Gibby, this is Madison. I have been listening to episode 187 of Stephen Ray Thatcher, and you guys were talking about how he had to fly back from Tennessee to Missouri for his court date. And I actually live in Springfield, Missouri, which is funny enough that part of this happened here. But my brother is actually on the fugitive squad up in northern Missouri, and he flies all around the United States to pick up prisoners of the state and fly them back. So, yes, they do fly on commercial flights with all the other common folk. But they are handcuffed and they are masked now. So I just thought that was interesting. I had to stop my work day to come and call you guys and tell you that, yes, they do fly on commercial flights. So maybe if you're lucky enough, one day you'll get on a flight and be on there with a criminal. All right. Well, you guys stay safe and keep your own time ticking.
You know, it'd be really cool when they bring him on the plane handcuffed with a mask. You got to put that Hannibal Lecter mask on.
It's exactly what I was thinking. My luck, if I ever was on a commercial flight, they'd have to wheel him in on a dolly, and he'd have the Hannibal Lecter thing on with the straight jacket.
Be perfect. That's the way to do it. You know, I'd be like, hey, I know this is a low-level crime, but can we put the cuffs on you?
Just to scare the, out of everybody on the flight. Yeah.
We got the Hannibal Lecter mask, and we have some baloney. We just want you to let it hang out a little bit out of the mask, and then just kind of slurp it in when people look at you.
With some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
Yeah.
All right. Buddy, we got to get out. That is another episode for True Crime All the Time Unsolved. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking.